I'm not a hero. I'm not a traitor. I'm an ordinary American. You know, I'm a citizen like anybody else in the room, and I'm just trying to do the best that I can.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk,
the ethics of whistleblowing with our guest, former NSA contractor Edward Snowden.
When you basically are requiring individuals to report wrongdoing to those responsible for the wrongdoing, that's kind of like asking the lamb to beg pardon from the lion.
Who gets to decide whether government secrets should be revealed to the public?
Aren't whistleblowers the last defense against government overreach?
Whistleblowers are elected by circumstance. You know, nobody self-nominates to be a whistleblower because it's so painful.
Is whistleblowing a matter of duty or a matter of choice?
Aren't some bad acts best kept secret?
When legality and morality begin to separate, we all have a moral obligation to act to do something about that.
The Ethics of Whistleblowing with Edward Snowden. Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Cubberly Auditorium on the Stanford University campus as part of the Distinguished Speaker Series of the Symbolic Systems Program.
Our conversations begin just a stone's throw from here over at Philosopher's Corner. That's where Ken teaches philosophy, and I taught philosophy for 40 joyful years.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about the ethics of whistleblowing with Edward Snowden, one of the world's most famous whistleblowers.
Well, Ken, I mean, I'll tell you my view. Whistleblowers do us all a great service. They shine the light of truth into the dark corners where governments and corporations operate and hide their dirty secrets. Although they're often hounded by the law, to me, they're among the heroes of democracy.
You know, John, many things that governments and corporations do in the shadows, as you put it aptly, they do deserve to be exposed. But really now, we can't have solitary individuals deciding for themselves which government secrets to keep and which ones to leak. That's a recipe for chaos.
So you'd rather just see the government have the right to engage in massive, warrantless secret surveillance of ordinary citizens like you and me and the people in this audience without adequate oversight or input from a public? That's a recipe for a police state, unchecked by anything except its own whims.
Well, now you're alluding to the Patriot Act and the NSA surveillance program that it supposedly authorized. Highly controversial, I admit. Even as we speak, Congress is hotly debating whether to reauthorize it or to let it expire.
Thanks largely to the courage and self-sacrifice of Edward Snowden.
My point was, as flawed as the Patriot Act may be, there's one thing you have to say for it, John.
And that would be?
It's the law. Voted on by both houses of Congress, signed by the president, who, last time I checked, were all actually empowered by the public, through elections, to make laws on behalf of us all. And as the law, John, as the law, you have to respect it. It deserves respect.
Not if it's ill-conceived and unjust. Not if it's so opaque that even supporters don't really know what it means. I mean, Dianne Feinstein, she's a good senator, a good person. She thought she was on top of this, but it was obvious after the Snowden leaks, she didn't know what metadata was. She didn't know what she was involved with at all. It doesn't deserve respect if it's cynically used as a pretext for doing things in secret that the people, the ultimate masters in a democracy, would never stand for if they actually knew about it.
Look, there's one thing you left out in your little tirade, though, John, speaking of democracy. The importance of respect for the rule of law. Without that, you don't have democracy. You've got anarchy.
Well, Ken, you're confusing respect for the law with a fetish for following the law, even when it makes you do wrong things. Sometimes you just have to stand up and be counted. You have to challenge the law.
I don't deny that. Who would deny that? But you should challenge the law Through lawful means.
Well, what if the very act of challenging it has been made unlawful? If the law has sworn you to secrecy on pain of prosecution, what if that fact cows everyone in the system into silence? What do you do then? Shut up and just become another cog in the machine?
That's not what I'm saying. Look, I'm a law-abiding citizen. I respect the law. I want to be inside the law. But I don't, frankly, want to be a person who simply goes along to get along. I've never thought of myself as that.
Well, you're now showing signs of beginning to appreciate the dilemma that many whistleblowers have actually faced. Most of these whistleblowers are patriots, not radical revolutionaries. That's why they got in on the inside in the first place. They thought they were doing something worthwhile. They would love to work within the law, within the system, but sometimes, given what they see, they simply can't. And it takes great moral courage to out the very government whose secrets you've sworn to uphold. Sometimes a higher duty calls.
Yeah, but what if this well-intentioned whistleblower listening to the higher duty ends up doing great damage to the country he professes to love? How can someone be so cocksure he's doing the right thing, especially when the law forbids it, and when peers and superiors, also working in the trenches on the inside, refuse to see things the same way? How about that, John?
Well, Ken, that's the risk involved in being courageous. You're a traitor if you get it wrong. You're a hero if you get it right. Whistleblowing is not for the faint of heart. But let me ask you, what would you do if you discovered that the government had targeted you for surveillance?
To answer that question, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari, to interview an innocent person who was targeted by the FBI. She files this report.
It's March 2010. A young college student named Yasser Afifi is at the auto shop. He's getting a routine oil change. But when the mechanic looks under the car, he finds a GPS tracking device. A few days later, Yasser notices two shady-looking people hanging out near his car. More than a little paranoid at this point, he goes outside to confront them.
And I'm being 19 and I'm puffing up my chest like, what's going on? What's happening? And that's where I guess it all begins, really, where I'm finally face to face with two FBI agents.
The agents told Yasser they'd put the tracking device on his car, and now they wanted it back. They also wanted to ask Yasser a few questions, really detailed questions.
In a very short period of time, I realized they knew my whereabouts, they knew where I was going, who I was hanging out with, what restaurants I was going to. They knew I got a new job, and they couldn't have known that information unless if they had listened in on phone calls and reviewed my emails. I found that very shocking.
That's why in 2011, Yasser decided to sue the FBI.
We allege that his Fourth Amendment rights were violated because there was no warrant for the GPS tracking device that was used.
Zahra Bilu is with the Council on American Islamic Relations, a Muslim advocacy group. She's Yasser's lawyer. Bilu says Muslim Americans like Yasser have been fighting against unwarranted government surveillance pretty much since 9/11, but it's a fight that was largely unnoticed until Edward Snowden.
He's an American former CIA employee and computer technician. Today he came out as the leaker of classified NSA documents that spell out a secret surveillance program.
The Snowden leak made these issues more relatable to our fellow Americans. It's sad that it took surveillance on all Americans for all Americans to care, but I think we're by nature self-interested. Snowden showed us that we are all impacted by this, and so the self-interest has shifted and people care now.
After the leak, Bilu's team joined other advocacy groups to sue the NSA for its cell phone surveillance program. I asked Bilu, isn't there a chance the government is listening to us right now? I mean, she is the head of a Muslim American advocacy group.
They possibly are. And I operate from the perspective that it's better to assume that they are and not say anything I wouldn't want them to hear than to be surprised that they were listening. It's unfortunate. It's a frightening way to live.
Yasser Afifi, the guy who found the FBI tracking device on his car, says the same thing.
I feel like I'm still being watched. I feel like my every move is documented, and I feel like I would be naive not to believe that. And again, if that's how I feel, what does that mean for the rest of everyone else?
Today, Yasser is married with three kids. He works at a marketing agency, and his wife is a yoga instructor. Even though it's been 5 years since he found the FBI tracking device on his car, the awareness, the amount of attention his case received, still ripples across the nation.
It ripples through books, it ripples through authors and voices and radios, and we're talking about it 5 years later, you and I. People are listening to this because this is a problem, this is a growing concern.
In the spring of 2015, Yasser's case against the FBI was dismissed. One of the reasons cited was that Yasser, quote, contacted local and national media to share his story. But Yasser's glad he shared. He says losing the lawsuit doesn't matter. If his personal story can help people learn how to assert their own rights and protect themselves from being violated by government agencies, then he's won where it matters the most. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
I'm John Perry. Thanks, Shuka, for that interesting story about life in contemporary America. Very inspiring. I'm here along with my fellow philosopher, Ken Taylor, and we're coming to you from Coverley Auditorium on the Stanford campus.
Our guest today is one of the world's, is the world's most famous whistleblower. He's a former contractor for the National Security Agency. He saw the workings of the NSA up close and personal, and he decided to take matters into his own hands to start a debate, he says. Please welcome to the Philosophy Talk stage, by teleconference from Moscow, Edward Snowden.
Thank you.
Ed, a lot of people see you as a hero. But others, and intelligent ones too, have called you a narcissistic traitor, emblematic of an atomized generation, whatever an atomized generation is. How do you see yourself at this point?
This is a really common question that is asked a lot, and I think it's actually got one of the least interesting answers because I don't. I mean, I don't think about myself. I don't think about how I'm going to be perceived because it's not about me. It's about us. You know, I'm not a hero. I'm not a traitor. I'm an ordinary American. You know, I'm a citizen like anybody else in the room, and I'm just trying to do the best that I can. I'm not beyond question. And, you know, in fact, I should be questioned. Anybody who's trying to do things that could have serious impacts, you know, should be. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't try. And we certainly shouldn't be afraid that we'll be called names.
So, Ed, let me follow up. I mean, you're taking us into the mind of the whistleblower. Now, unlike your average hacktivist on a mission, I imagine most whistleblowers start out as committed insiders. I mean, that's how come they're in a position to blow whistles. Given that, and given the possibility of prison, exile, maybe even worse, what drives a person to take this kind of action?
That's a complex question. It requires a lot of nuance. But if I think about it on sort of the topmost level, there are a lot of risks. You know, I certainly paid for it myself. I lived in Hawaii. I had a, you know, wonderful girlfriend, a home, a happy family, a successful career. And to walk away from that, I think it does require a real commitment to something because everybody knows the risks, particularly in the national security space where the government always has strong incentives to make examples out of people. They want to protect their authority, to shield programs from oversight. And really from criticism and review by the public. But I think the driving principle there, and it's different probably for everybody, is that you have to have a greater commitment to justice than you do a fear of the law.
Yeah, but you know, that sounds really good in the abstract, and you live that. But it must be a hard thing. Because you started out, as John said in the opening, you were an insider. I mean, you worked for the CIA. I mean, you were an insider. You had a very high-level clearance. So you must have been a believer at some point, right? So, I mean, I just want to understand the process a little bit, how that belief kind of got eroded.
So it's one of those things where, yes, you're right. You know, I actually, while everyone else was protesting, I signed up for the military in 2004. I believe I began process in 2003 when everyone else was protesting because I believed what the government was saying. I could not believe the argument that the government was lying to us. You know, we were going into Iraq, it was claimed, to free the oppressed. And I wanted to help, even if it meant some risk to myself. But over time, particularly as you work in the government, as you work in intelligence agencies, the CIA, DIA, NSA, you're exposed to more and more information of increasing levels of classification. And you begin to see that oftentimes classification is not used to prevent the threat of harm or the loss of programs, but actually to prevent embarrassment by senior officials doing things behind closed doors that the public would not approve of or may not be legal. And when you see that over time, everybody has a level. I think we all have a limit of the level of injustice, of incivility, of inhumanity that we can kind of accept in our daily life and ignore. We turn our eyes away from the beggar on the street. But we also have a breaking point. And when people find that, they act.
This is Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Stanford campus as part of the Distinguished Speaker Series of the Symbolic System Program. Our guest is former NSA contractor and famed whistleblower and thoughtful guy, Edward Snowden.
How should a whistleblower weigh the conflict between the duties of his station and the call from some higher duty? When are the obligations of your job trumped by some higher responsibility? And what happens if you get it wrong?
Whistleblowing, a matter of duty or a matter of choice? Along with questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back to Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Coverley Auditorium on the Stanford campus. Our guest is in Moscow. He's a former NSA contractor, Edward Snowden. And we're thinking about the ethics of whistleblowing in the age of information.
How should a potential whistleblower weigh the conflict between the duties to her employer on the one hand and the call of some higher duty on the other? Should a cost be imposed on someone who abandons her station to answer the call of a higher duty? Now, you can answer the call of a more or less high duty by stepping to the microphones on the aisles on either side of the stage.
Ed, so if something is a matter of duty, then you have to do it. Maybe not physically, of course, but morally. On the other hand, if it's a matter of choice, you don't have to do it. You can do it if you choose, you take your risk, but morality doesn't demand you to do it. So how should we think about the decision to blow the whistle? Is it a matter of duty or is it a matter of choice? What do you think?
So I'll have to caveat this with the fact that I'm more of a practitioner than I am a theoretician in this space, but...
That's all right, we want your lived experience.
You've got some leisure time now, so you can read a lot.
So when I think about it, you know, one of the central questions and central criticisms is about, you know, respect for the law. For example, when you join the intelligence community in the United States, you're asked to sign a non-disclosure agreement, a standard government form called SF-312. It actually only affords for civil penalties, not criminal penalties. But the language that's used to describe this by politicians castigating whistleblowers is they call it an oath. But in fact, it's not an oath. However, when I entered on duty at the CIA, I was asked to swear an actual oath, what was called the oath of service. And that is to protect the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Not a particular program, not a policy, and not the prerogatives of any official, whether that be Congress, the courts, or even the president. And if in our system it was not considered desirable for individuals to do this, to stand up and defend the Constitution when they see unconstitutional activities, we would not, in my opinion, be asked to take that oath. If they didn't want people to do it, they certainly shouldn't ask us to, because someone will take it seriously. But when we measure that, I think the distinction here, and I apologize, but let me make the key point, is the distinction between respect for the law and subservience to it. There are times that any individual can witness, and in the history of our own country, it doesn't take long to think back and imagine examples, where the law becomes distinct from morality. And when legality and morality begin to separate, we all have a moral obligation to act to do something about that. But this is different for every individual. Some are motivated by morality, some are motivated by self-interest. They want to have a better world where they don't live with those kind of programs. And I myself don't feel that I was acting specifically out of a sense of altruism, but because this is the world that we're all going to leave behind. This is the world that we're all building step by step. And when I see that the work that I was doing, and all of my colleagues are doing when I discuss this with them privately, is being subverted not only against our intentions, but contrary to the public's intent, I felt an obligation to act.
So, Ed, one criticism that's been leveled at you, or something that kind of comes in along the sides around the edges, is a kind of, who does he think he is? And as I understand it, the basic idea is, look, there's lots of people at NSA that knew what you knew. There was probably lots of people at NSA, maybe the majority of the people that weren't in charge, who were squeamish about it, who didn't think it was quite right, who didn't think you were quite squaring with the American people. Now, you thought what you did is right. Do you think the failure of all those other people means that they were wrong? Do you think you had a duty to do what you did so that everyone else must have had the same duty? Or is it just that no one was obliged to do this, but still, it's a good thing if somebody does? We're trying to figure out just how you thought of it. Did you really think you were someone special? And if so, what made you special? Was it just that you're the only one who's you?
I hope that's clear. Certainly not special in any regard like that. And it is a fair question. This is something that needs to be asked by everyone confronting these kind of positions. But again, it comes back to a principle of inferior and superior obligations. You have a civil agreement, this wonderful SF-312, and then you have an oath to the Constitution. Now, it obligates you, if you see unconstitutional activity, to act to try to correct that, to curtail that, to improve that in some way. And people can say, we have elected officials who should know about this. But the problem was they didn't know about it. This failed comprehensively at all levels, including the most senior official in the national intelligence community, Director of National Intelligence James Clapper, who actually made a false statement under oath to Congress on camera in front of the nation and said that the NSA was not, in fact, collecting any information at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans.
Ed, I don't want to interrupt you, but I want to interject something there. So there are lots of people positioned as you were. Well, not a huge number, but a fair number of people positioned as you were. You acted singularly. I believe you took what you thought to be the action of last resort, right? But the thing you just said made me wonder something. I watched that clip of Clapper lying to, it was Senator Wyden, I think, who asked him that question. Why didn't you contact his staff and him and say, you've just been lied to, come over to my office, and then you go through Congress rather than risk exile and imprisonment. I mean, I think the government wants to put you in prison for a very long time.
Life or more, if they get what they would like. But it is a fair thing. And the issue there is that Senator Wyden knew he had been lied to, but he had no capability to reveal that. Had he told Director of National Intelligence James Clapper that he was lying on the floor of Congress, he would have lost his seat on the Senate Intelligence Oversight Committee, because he would have revealed classified information. And this is something that he has himself said. He provided the questions 24 hours in advance. So it was no surprise to the director. He has people who brief him, who prepare his statements in advance. And he also told the director 24 hours after the fact that he had given false testimony and he should correct it. The director instead declined, said no. And we, the public, of course, I sitting at my desk knew about this, as did my colleagues, that it was a lie. But he didn't correct this until after it was made public in the media in the wake of the 2013 revelations. And so I think the real challenge here is, if there is an opportunity within the system to correct the unconstitutional behavior, of course, an individual will take that path because it is less costly to them. That's where the incentives lie. But again, the system failed comprehensively. Rather than 535 members of Congress knowing about these programs, only the so-called Gang of Eight was briefed on covert action programs. Of these, because the Gang of Eight is comprised of the most senior members of Congress, they have very little understanding of technology. They're not allowed to bring in aides who understand it to get it reviewed. And the level of oversight that we enjoy as a society suffers because of this. Correspondingly, the courts tried to review these programs. In May 2013, this was brought before the Supreme Court in a case called Amnesty versus Clapper, but they rejected it, saying because no one could prove that they had been spied on, even though it was in fact occurring, the case was speculative. And they shouldn't, the court had no standing, no capability to review it, to render a decision. And so the courts were frozen out. The majority of Congress was frozen out. The public was frozen out. And the executive itself, the director of national intelligence, just a few days ago, his lawyer, Bob Litt, said that the reason he gave that false statement was because he simply forgot about it. He had forgotten about a program that was spying on millions of Americans.
So I want to pick out one thing you said in that. You said a lot of stuff, all very interesting. But you said something about self-correcting. It sounds like you believe, and part of your justification for your action, and maybe this could be a generalized justification for a whistleblower, is that these systems are not built to self-correct. So the singular individual who's placed to know things that others can't know may in fact have a duty, not just a choice, but a duty. Because we all have an interest in these systems correcting themselves. So, am I getting the drift of your thought correctly? I mean, because the system is incapable of self-correction and because individuals placed inside the system have a singular opportunity to aid the correction of the system, they are called on as a matter of duty to do so. Would you agree with that as a summary of your talk?
To me, yes. That's what the oath of service means. I've said it before in the context of whistleblowers are elected by circumstance. You know, nobody self-nominates to be a whistleblower because it's so painful. Your lives are destroyed regardless of whether you're right or wrong. Thomas Drake, who tried to reveal the warrantless wiretapping program and classic waste, fraud, and abuse at the National Security Agency, he lost his career. He lost his home. He lost his wife, his marriage, and now, rather than being a senior executive at the National Security Agency, which is a very privileged position, he works in an Apple store, and he had to plead guilty to a misdemeanor, even though they tried to put him away for something near to life. This is not something that people sign up for. It's something that they're forced into a position to do.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking to Edward Snowden about the ethics of whistleblowing in front of a live audience at Stanford University, and we've got a whole lineup of questions from that live audience. I'll start on that side of the room, and welcome to Philosophy Talk. I can't really see out there.
Hello, my name is Pega from Palo Alto. I have a general question about whistleblowing. I'm wondering if you think that the intent or the reasons behind the whistleblowing make any difference in the analysis of whether it's ethical
or
not.
Good question. What do you think of that, Ed? I know you've thought about this one.
It's a really important question, and it really differs from case to case. I do think it's important to consider the intent, and this is one of the chief failures in the laws that are used to prosecute whistleblowers today. For example, I would love, and I have offered to the government on many occasions, to come back and to basically defend myself in court and argue that these disclosures were made in the public interest. Unfortunately, the laws that are used to prosecute whistleblowers prohibit a public interest defense. You're not allowed even to use the word public interest or whistleblowing at trial, which was in the case of Thomas Drake. Instead, they prosecute them as spies, as though they were selling information about like human intelligence sources that gets people executed to foreign governments for their own gain. But even in the context of whistleblowing, there is some degree of separation that occurs there. For example, in the Pentagon Papers case, the famous one of Daniel Ellsberg, he wanted to reveal that the government had extended the Vietnam War on the basis of lies. He wanted to save lives and end a war. Mark Felt, who was behind the famous Watergate disclosures, Deep Throat for Bob Woodward and Bernstein, actually it's theorized now that the chief reason that he came forward was because he was dissatisfied with the fact that he had been passed over for the director of FBI. And so he thought, by making this disclosure and causing a scandal, he could free that chair up again and get a second bite at the apple. However, even though he had bad intent, it served good ends.
Right. Now, I understand that you, from reading and listening to some of your other interviews, that you weren't actually trying to stop this policy, this practice, as much as cause a debate about this practice. And that's part of the reason you handled the leaks the way you did. Am I getting that right?
That is correct. Something that's been overlooked is the fact that I never published a single document on my own, because I believe that the model, the ideal of American government is actually quite a strong one. I tried to emulate the model of checks and balances by, instead of simply making a unilateral decision that the world must know, I worked with the free press, institutions that everybody trusts, American journalists, to say, let them make the decision about what the public should know, and just in case they had gone too far or perhaps they had misunderstood a document, allow the government in advance of publication to review the story and simply make sure that there was no egregious harm or threat to life of a story that the journalist had simply missed. And by doing this, by involving multiple parties that had conflicting interests there, we would try to basically serve the public interest in the most generous way while mitigating the most serious risks.
Man, I'm trying to get some more questions in there. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Thank you. My name is Carl Hewitt. Given the current level of surveillance, is it ethical for a reporter to allow somebody in the NSA to become a whistleblower while they are still in the U.S.?
This is really challenging because, having lived it, I can tell you that even the best-intentioned reporters are not going to be a really reliable adversary for the National Security Agency. Mm-hmm. You're right that it's very difficult to defend a source in that example. However, ultimately, the source-journalist relationship is almost always driven by the source. These are volunteers. These are people trying to do something. A journalist digging into the NSA and trying to develop a source could be creating a very serious risk of harm. But at the same time, it's almost always, in my understanding and experience of the press, which is, of course, not expert, that it's a voluntary relationship.
Let's take one last question before the break. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
I'm Ian. I'm a computer science student at Stanford. And I was curious, the Symbolic Systems Society recently held a screening of Laura Poitras's Citizen Four, and we saw the level of care and attentiveness that you had in leaking the information to journalists, like you just said. Do you feel that the leaks made by Chelsea Manning to Julian Assange, which were then published on WikiLeaks, were also ethical? Would it have been better for them to have also gone through journalists, or do you feel that that was a valid decision?
I think the work of WikiLeaks is important to the free press because it creates an alternative. If, for example, the press becomes too beholden to the interests of sort of the government due to the need to maintain access to government officials, for example, for comment on stories, to press releases, access to the president's plane for travel and so on, those incentives can undermine the independence of free press. And the WikiLeaks model can basically provide an alternative where, much like with whistleblowing, if all other parts of the system fails, there's a fallback. There's an ultimate choice that can provide real sort of unvarnished truth in the most extreme circumstances. And I think it's important that we maintain that, regardless of whether or not the particular standard in this or that case was what you would ideally desire. When we look at the results of that case, for example, specifically in the court-martial, the government was never able to show even a single instance of harm. So whether or not it was handled in the way that, you know, a particular individual would say, that's what I would do, the result was not as harmful as it was initially presented in the press.
So you don't see any big harm having come out of the WikiLeaks way of doing it, but you yourself took a lot more precautions. Is that fair to say?
I wouldn't draw that distinction personally because that's not my place to say. That's something that should be made, a distinction that should be drawn by other people. But what I will say is it's not me who's saying no harm has resulted from it. That's actually the government itself. They had an opportunity at a trial to present evidence, and they declined to do so.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about the ethics of whistleblowing with former NSA contractor Edward Snowden.
Whistleblowers might not be necessary if our government were more transparent and more democratically accountable. In our final segment, we'll ask what we can do to diminish the need for whistleblowers in the first place, if anything.
We're coming to you as part of the Distinguished Speaker Series of the Symbolic Systems Program here at Stanford. We'll take more questions from our audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is former NSA contractor Edward Snowden, and we're thinking about the ethics of whistleblowing in the age of information. We got a ton of questions, so why don't we go start. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi, my name is Lachlan. I'm from Boston. And I was just wondering, you know, there's been all this more greater discussion and people changing their opinion. But do you really believe that the policy will change given how hard it is to check what these people are doing?
That's a really good question.
That is a really good question. And I think it's a two-pronged approach. I think we do need to change laws. I do think we need to hold public officials to account for some of the abuses, some of the failures that we've seen come out of the NSA through these programs. The first one is we need to stop mass surveillance. Because we know not only is it a fundamental degradation of our rights, of our liberty, but that it is ineffective. We've been intercepting the phone calls of everybody in the country, and yet it didn't stop the Boston Marathon bombings. It didn't stop, actually, and this is not my assertion. This is from the White House itself. So we need to do that. First off, we need to stop bulk collection. But then the second thing is in the whistleblowing process. How do we make sure that people are protected, that they can go through this inside the system? And the idea here, and the most fundamental one, that was, for example, in my case, there were no whistleblower protections for me. If I had taken these documents to Congress, I would have gone to jail. Not only would that have happened, but basically nothing would have changed, because the Congressional Intelligence Committee that was overseeing this, and the Gang of Eight, for example, these were the individuals most responsible for the wrongdoing in the first place. When you basically are requiring individuals to report wrongdoing to those responsible for the wrongdoing, that's kind of like asking the lamb to beg pardon from the lion. That's not the model that we want to use. So we need some sort of independent body there that's apolitical, that has public advocates there, sort of civil liberties advocates, non-governmental bodies there that are trusted institutions that we can use to regulate things when everything else fails.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Kyle. I'm from New Jersey. My question is about, I've gotten very interested in the voices of the unheard, specifically in prisons, and I'm wondering about your thoughts of how to facilitate the spread of truth and knowledge in places like Guantanamo Bay and the voices of the unheard in prisons, and how a country can go about facilitating that.
Wow, that's a heavy, interesting question. Do you have thoughts about this question?
This is a really challenging question. It's difficult to answer in a soundbite, so I don't want to do it a disservice. But what I will say is that it's important that we really understand that the commitment to freedom of speech, even from those we disagree with, is the keystone of our democracy. This is really what all of the other rights that we enjoy in the Bill of Rights and all of our standards, our commitments through international treaties and whatnot rely upon. And we see in advanced Western democracies, you know, liberal democracies that we would expect much better from, a frightening and very concerning questioning of our commitment to those principles. The Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, David Cameron, said that we have been too liberal and too tolerant for too long, and simply obeying the law will no longer excuse you from government scrutiny and interference in your private lives. And this is something that I think is a fundamental rejection of the last and most important centuries of Western development. And we need to defend against that sort of abrasion of our liberties in all ways that we can.
But if you take off from what Cameron said, now my extensive knowledge of Great Britain is all based on watching TV, but I gather that now there, you know, if you commit a crime in London, the chances are that you were caught on one or two or many video surveillance things, and whether that's true or not, American TV watchers are exposed to this picture, and most people don't seem to mind. They say, "Well, if it cuts down on crime, what do I care?" And even, you know, John Oliver tried to bring home examples that the average American could relate to. But the people, I mean, when I was a kid, you know, Americans were very proud of the fact we didn't have ID cards. We didn't have numbers. Your Social Security number was emphasized as not an identification number. Now nobody seems to mind. Is it, are you just kind of stuck in an older generation and,
pretty young.
And people your age and millennials, except for you, actually don't care if the NSA knows everything? Maybe like in the cartoon, maybe if the NSA would keep my Google calendar up to date for me, it would be okay if they listened in on everything. Are you just kind of behind the times with your concern about these particular kinds of liberties?
I don't think so. And I think the young members of the audience would actually strongly agree with me in that regard because they've seen the danger of everything.
They just did.
Well, thank you. Thanks for backing me up, guys, on that one. I have to say, because really, this is the fundamental question that has been, or criticism that the government, the defense that the government has asserted when everyone was scandalized by realizing that we had been watched in secret, in similar to the ways that, you know, we used to use to distinguish ourselves from our adversaries. We've lost the Soviet Union as an adversary. You know, they no longer exist. But we used to hold up the, you know, expansive, pervasive surveillance of that space as sort of a self-arguing demonstration of the fact that we had a better, more just system. For us back then, and I think still for young people today, the idea, the argument that I don't care about privacy because I have nothing to say is no different than saying I don't care about free speech, or I don't care about privacy because I have nothing to hide is no different from saying I don't care about free speech because I have nothing to say. It really comes in to the idea that it's not about nothing to hide. It's about something to lose,
but
our
Ed,
rights.
Ed,
and they're not individual, they're collective.
But Ed, young people have swarmed the internet. And it's because of the, I'm no technical person in this domain, but I've thought about this in connection with what's been happening to you.
You're the head of our symbolic system.
I know. I'm a philosophy professor. But I've thought about this a lot in connection with you. Look, think about a highway. Right, and you're driving your car along the highway, and you get off an exit, and you get off there, and you go all kinds of places. You're out in the public in your car. Okay, nobody can kind of get in your car and hear what you're saying, but the internet is like a highway that's extraordinarily easy to constantly monitor. Whenever you make a phone call, whenever you send an email, you're putting it in your car, and you're driving it along the highway, and it's extraordinarily easy to monitor it. You don't have to have a person monitoring it. Just do some computer algorithms. These young people have bought into this thing whole hog. Every time they send a text, every time they're driving their car in public, right? They think they're private. I mean, if they think that they have some reasonable expectation of privacy, they're deluded. They don't know how this thing works. There's no reasonable expectation of privacy when you're driving your car along the highway. Any helicopter can fly over and see what the traffic is doing. Well, any NSA or any foreign government can see what the traffic is doing and do all kinds of computation over that traffic. So aren't they just being deluded?
I would say there are fairly significant differences between the highway example, the analogy, and the internet. You know, the highway stops in front of our home. The internet goes into the walls of our home and also within the confines of our mind. That's where we confide with friends. That's where we express ourselves. That's where we develop our thoughts. It's where we decide what we believe in and who we want to be. And this, giving government access to this space is fundamentally different than the spaces of the highway. It's also less voluntary. It is at least plausible that an individual could choose, if highways were monitored, to say, I don't want to engage with highways. Rather, I'm going to live in the city. I'm going to walk on foot. I'm not going to be observed. But you can't opt out of the internet. Even if you live in your home, even if you don't own a cell phone, even if you don't own a computer, your census data travels over the internet.
Well, my point is, you can't opt out of the internet, but the internet is not a private highway. Look, even if you opt in, you're giving Google, Facebook, and the government says, I want in too, right? I mean, you can't opt out of it.
There's a young lady over there that wants in. Yeah.
Oh, yes, okay. John's saying I should take another question from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, ma'am.
Hi, I'm Kathy from New Jersey, and as a young person, I can assure you that I care deeply about privacy. But Recent segments in the news, I think that people have suggested that a vast percentage of Americans, or at least a good number of Americans, aren't aware of the implications of what you did or even who you are. Where the government has criticized your revelations for allowing terrorist organizations and other organizations to heighten their security so that perhaps the American public that you meant to protect is not aware of what you've done, even as terrorist organizations whom the NSA is supposed to be fighting against were able to change how they secure their communications accordingly. So do you feel that that changes the ethics of what you've done if perhaps the public is not being protected and yet other organizations were able to lock down accordingly?
This is another fairly common criticism that's important to respond to, not just for me, but for anybody who cares about this right, our rights, because it seems persuasive. It seems reasonable. But it's important to distinguish one thing, which is that it's not a fact that this has helped terrorists. It's an allegation. And in fact, there's no evidence to support the assertion that it's true. We've even got the Director of National Intelligence, Michael Rogers, who said under testimony to Congress that actually not much has changed. We've had private studies that show that Al-Qaeda, for example, has not changed its communications in response to the revelations. And we know for a fact that terrorists already knew about this. Osama bin Laden, who is fairly well known as a terrorist, stopped using a cell phone famously not in 2001 or 2010 or 2013, but 1998. He stopped using a cell phone in 1998. But, and the reason why is terrorists are paying attention to this stuff because they don't need news reports, right? It affects them personally. When all of their friends have cell phones and are hit by missiles, when everybody who goes to a cyber cafe is arrested, they realize how that happened without a press report. The people who suffer from a lack of public evidence are not terrorists, they're citizens.
You know, one last question, if you keep it brief.
Oh, hi, my name is Philippe. I'm with the Information Security Office here at Stanford, where our job is to protect university assets from all unauthorized eyes, no matter which country they come from. Anyway, my question to you is, now that you know what you know, would you find another method to release the information you have that would not be so costly to you?
I actually don't think so. Although I would certainly love to have not paid the costs, I think it was necessary in many ways because it shielded my colleagues from coming under scrutiny. If I had stayed in the shadows and basically allowed the press to work on this, there would have been a giant whodunit. Everybody would have basically lost their clearances, lost their access, lost their jobs, lost their livelihood as sort of a witch hunt was sparked to stop people from learning what was going on. By identifying me, I called sort of the target on myself and everybody else who was concerned about these programs. But, you know, I had to worry about myself. I had to worry about my girlfriend, things like that. But other people had children. You know, they had ill relatives, parents and things like that who they had to take care of. And for me, I could bear the costs, but not everyone else could.
Yeah, this has been a really fascinating conversation. I wish we could have you for another couple of hours. So much I'd like to talk to you about. But right now I'm going to have to thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Our guest has been former NSA contractor and our era's most renowned and I think most thoughtful whistleblower, Edward Snowden. So, John, what are you thinking? And what are you thinking now? You ready to blow some whistles?
I would have been tempted had I found dirty little secrets in Stanford's corners over the years, but I never found many. I mean, some unkempt psychologists here and there, but not much else. I admire Snowden, I must admit, and from the reading I've done, it looks like he was very careful to prevent people from being injured, undisclosed. There is the question, which I don't think we've totally settled, exactly under what conditions is a person, should they feel entitled, should they feel obliged, should they feel they have the right to take those decisions upon themselves? The conversation will continue. With respect to America,
I'm pretty depressed. I think with gerrymandered Congress and the money that controls it, democracy is in plenty of trouble, even without the NSA.
Well, one of the things we didn't talk about, which I wish we had time to talk about, is the last thing. How do we democratically regulate systems like this? I mean, I think it's extraordinarily hard. I mean, this thing about the internet, I mean, the disanalogies to the physical highway actually make it worse. It makes it easier for watchful eyes to find out all kinds of things just through the collection of metadata. It's an extraordinary thing.
In Europe, they tend more to restrict the ability of companies and the government to collect data. Here, we tend to put safeguards on their disclosing the data. And I suspect here, as in many cases, Europe has it right.
This conversation will continue at Philosopher's Corner, at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is, cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. You too can become a partner in that community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2015.
Our executive producer is David Demeris. Special thanks to Todd Davies, Juan Lee, Gabby Magana, and the Symbolic Systems Program here at Stanford. Thanks also to Ben Weisner, Esther McDonald, Mike Godinez, and Gordon Gurley.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is director of research. The marketing director is Dave Millar, and James Hanley is our research assistant.
Thanks also to Dan Brandon, Crystal Nickerson, and Carola Kreitman.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.